All right, let's dive into a Supreme Court case that's, I think you'll agree, a real legal thriller.
I'm ready.
We're talking Olden v. Kentucky.
Yeah, fascinating case.
This case, it revolves around the Sixth Amendment, witness credibility, and, well, a pretty tangled web of relationships, really.
It really does.
It's a story that highlights how race, bias, and the right to confront your accuser can collide in the courtroom.
Yeah.
And it has implications that are important even today.
Definitely. I think what's particularly interesting about Olden v. Kentucky is how it exposes the challenges. You know, like the challenges of balancing a defendant's right to a fair trial with the need to protect witnesses.
Right.
Especially when you have these sensitive issues like race and interracial relationships.
Okay, so let's set the stage for this legal drama. It's the 1980s in Kentucky.
All right.
We have James Olden, a black man, who was accused of sexually assaulting Starla Matthews, a white woman.
Okay.
Now, Olden, he claims the encounter was consensual.
Right.
And he's saying that Matthews is making up the story to protect her relationship with a man named Bill Russell.
This is where things get really interesting. Matthews' story, it keeps changing.
Mm-hmm.
First, she says she was attacked by four men.
Wow.
Then it's down to just Olden and another man. So, you know, these inconsistencies, I mean, they raise serious questions about her credibility.
Yeah. So you've got this he said, she said situation.
Mm-hmm.
And Olden's lawyer is thinking, something's fishy here.
Yeah.
He wants to cross-examine Matthews about her relationship with Russell, arguing that it gives her a motive to lie.
Mm.
Seems like a pretty standard legal strategy,
right?
Right. I mean, the Sixth Amendment guarantees the right to confront your accuser.
You would think so, but the trial court,
they
said, nope, not happening.
What?
Yeah. They ruled that bringing up this interracial relationship in front of a jury would be too prejudicial.
Oh, wow.
And could unfairly sway their decision.
Against Olden. Wait a minute. So the court is basically saying, we can't let the jury hear about this potentially crucial piece of information, because they might be biased. I mean, doesn't that seem like a dangerous precedent?
Yeah, yeah.
Potentially, you know, shielding key evidence from the jury?
It does raise some serious concerns about how we ensure a fair trial, especially when sensitive social dynamics are at play.
Right.
But luckily for Olden, the case, it went up to the Supreme Court.
Okay.
And they had a very different take on the matter.
Okay, so what did the highest court in the land have to say about this whole mess? I mean, did they agree with the trial court's decision to, you know, exclude this potentially explosive information?
Not at all. In a resounding decision.
Okay.
The Supreme Court basically said that concerns about potential prejudice, you know, they can't be used as a reason to shut down a legitimate line of questioning.
Okay.
They emphasized that Olden's Sixth Amendment right to confront his accuser, that outweighs these concerns. Concerns about speculative racial bias in the jury.
That's a pretty powerful statement.
Yeah.
So the Supreme Court is basically saying you can't just, you know, sweep potentially crucial evidence under the rug.
Yeah.
Because it might make some people uncomfortable. The pursuit of truth. And a defendant's right to challenge the prosecution's case has to be, you know, a top priority.
Exactly. And this decision in Olden v. Kentucky didn't just impact that particular case.
No.
It set a precedent that has had ripple effects throughout the legal system. Even today, lawyers often cite Olden when challenging attempts to limit cross-examination based on these concerns about prejudice, especially in cases where, you know, you have race or gender or other sensitive social issues.
So it's like Olden v. Kentucky provided a legal roadmap for how to navigate these tricky waters, right?
Exactly.
Ensuring that a defendant's right to confront their accuser isn't trampled on.
Mm-hmm.
In the name of, you know, protecting witnesses or maintaining decorum in the courtroom.
Precisely. But let's dig a little deeper into the legal strategy at play in this case.
Okay.
Remember, Olden's lawyer couldn't just say Matthews is lying.
Right.
He had to carefully construct his argument
and
present evidence that highlighted her potential motive to fabricate the story. It's a classic example of how a skilled lawyer can connect the dots and create a compelling narrative, even when dealing with complex and potentially sensitive information.
So it's like a legal chess game where every move is calculated and strategic.
Yeah, yeah.
Olden's lawyer had to anticipate the prosecution's arguments, the court's concerns, and the potential reactions of the jury. He had to find a way to introduce this information about the relationship without triggering those concerns about prejudice.
Exactly. And this is where the case takes another interesting turn. Even though the Supreme Court ultimately sided with Olden, they still had to grapple with this idea of harmless error.
Harmless error.
They had to determine whether excluding this evidence about the relationship actually affected the outcome of the trial.
Harmless error. That sounds like one of those legal terms that's a lot more complicated than it seems.
It is.
What does that actually mean in this context?
Well, it's this legal principle that says even if a court makes an error during trial,
right,
it doesn't necessarily mean the verdict gets thrown out. If the error was minor and it didn't really impact the outcome of the case,
yeah,
it might be considered harmless.
So in this case, the Supreme Court is saying even though the trial court shouldn't have blocked that line of questioning about the relationship, maybe it wouldn't have made a difference anyway.
Exactly. They're saying we need to look at the whole picture,
right,
and determine whether this error was substantial enough to possibly change the jury's decision.
Okay.
It's a pretty nuanced concept, but it comes up all the time on appeal.
So you've got these two competing ideas.
Yeah.
On one hand, the Supreme Court is affirming Olden's right to confront his accuser, right?
Right.
But on the other hand, they're also acknowledging that sometimes errors happen during trial.
Right.
And we have to figure out if those errors were, you know, significant enough to warrant a new trial.
It really highlights how the law isn't always black and white. It's full of gray areas and judgment calls. And even the Supreme Court has to wrestle with those ambiguities.
Okay. So we've set the stage. We've got the Supreme Court ruling.
Yeah.
And we're starting to unpack this concept of harmless error.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm curious, what are some of the specific legal tactics Olden's lawyer used to build his case and overcome these hurdles? I mean, how did he actually convince the Supreme Court that his client's rights were violated?
Well, that's where it gets really interesting. And it's a masterclass in effective legal strategy. We'll dive into those details in just a bit.
Okay, sounds good. Okay, so we were talking about harmless error. But before we get back to that, I'm kind of curious about the specifics. Like, how did Olden's lawyer actually fight for his client's right to confront his accuser? What did he actually DO?
Well, one of the most important things Olden's lawyer did was to clearly articulate the link between Matthews' relationship with Russell,
yeah,
and her potential motive to lie.
Right, okay.
He argued that Matthews might have, you know, fabricated the assault allegation to conceal her relationship,
right, oh,
to conceal it from her family, the community, especially given the racial dynamics at the time.
Okay. So he's not just, you know, throwing out accusations, right?
No.
He's strategically connecting the dots.
Exactly.
Painting a picture for the court.
Oh.
Okay. But how did he actually present this argument? Was it just like his word against hers?
Absolutely not. A good lawyer, they never rely solely on speculation or conjecture. Olden's lawyer needed evidence to back up his claims.
Yeah.
He dug deep and uncovered inconsistencies in Matthew's various statements to the police and the court.
Right. Like, remember how her story about the number of attackers kept changing?
Yeah.
It was four men, then it was two.
Yeah.
I mean, that definitely raises some eyebrows.
Exactly. And Olden's lawyer used those inconsistencies to chip away at Matthew's credibility.
Okay.
He argued that these shifting accounts suggested she wasn't being truthful.
Yeah.
And that her relationship with Russell provided a plausible explanation, you know, for why she might be fabricating or embellishing the story.
So he's basically saying, hey, if her story keeps changing, maybe there's a reason for that.
Yeah.
And that reason might be tied to her desire to protect her relationship with this other man.
Exactly.
It's like a legal puzzle, right?
Yes.
And he's carefully piecing together the evidence to reveal this hidden motive.
You got it. It's a classic example of how a lawyer can use inconsistencies and circumstantial evidence to challenge the credibility of a witness.
Okay. But wouldn't the prosecution have countered that?
Oh, of course.
They must have had their own arguments against allowing this line of questioning about the relationship.
Absolutely. The prosecution argued that bringing up Matthew's relationship with Russell was irrelevant to the case.
Okay.
And would only serve to, prejudice the jury against her.
Right.
They claimed it was a distraction from the real issue, which was whether the sexual encounter was consensual or not.
Okay, so it's a clash of legal strategies.
Yeah.
Olden's lawyer is saying this relationship is crucial to understanding the witness's motive.
Mm-hmm.
While the prosecution's saying, no, it's a red herring meant to distract and inflame the jury.
Exactly. A classic example of the adversarial process at work, with both sides, fighting tooth and nail to present their version of the truth.
Okay. Well, if the prosecution was so concerned about prejudice, why didn't they just request a change of venue?
Huh.
Or ask for the jury to be sequestered? Wouldn't that have addressed their concerns about an outside influence?
Those are valid options,
right.
But they each come with their own set of challenges and drawbacks.
Right.
A change of venue can be expensive and time-consuming. And sequestering a jury, that can be incredibly disruptive to their lives.
Right, right.
Plus, it doesn't guarantee that jurors won't be exposed to information or opinions that could sway their decision.
So there's no easy fix.
Right.
It's a delicate balancing act, weighing the right to a fair trial against the potential for prejudice. And in this case, the Supreme Court ultimately decided that Olden's right to confront his accuser outweighed those concerns.
Right. But remember, the Supreme Court didn't just say the trial court was wrong to block that line of questioning. They also sent the case back down.
They did.
Yeah. For further proceedings to determine if that error was harmless.
Okay, so back to harmless error.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned earlier that it's, a complicated concept.
It is.
Then can you break it down for us a bit more?
Yeah.
Like, how does a court actually decide if an error was harmless or not?
Well, it involves, a lot of legal analysis and weighing different factors.
Okay.
The court has to look at the totality of the circumstances, the strength of the evidence, the nature of the error, and the potential impact it might have had on the jury's verdict.
Okay, so it's not like a simple checklist.
Right,
It's a judgment call based on the specifics of each case.
Exactly. There's no magic formula. And it's important to remember that harmless error doesn't mean the error was insignificant or unimportant.
Oh.
It just means that after careful consideration, the court determined that the error didn't fundamentally change the outcome of the trial.
So it seems like harmless error is a bit of a legal safety valve.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it.
It acknowledges that mistakes happen, but it also, aims to prevent minor missteps from derailing an otherwise fair trial.
That's a good way to think about it. It's a way for the legal system to, acknowledge human fallibility while still striving for justice.
Yeah, that makes sense. This all makes sense in the context of Olden v. Kentucky, but I'm curious, how does this concept of harmless error play out in other cases?
Yeah.
Are there any real world examples that would help illustrate how this principle works in practice?
Absolutely. There are countless examples of harmless error being applied in various legal contexts, from criminal trials to civil disputes. One that comes to mind is a case where a judge mistakenly allowed a piece of evidence to be presented to the jury,
okay,
but later realized the evidence was inadmissible.
Ooh, that sounds like a recipe for a mistrial.
You'd think so, right? But the appellate court, they ultimately ruled that the error was harmless.
They did.
Because the evidence was, relatively minor and wouldn't have swayed the jury's decision. Given the overwhelming evidence of the defendant's guilt, they basically said, even without that piece of evidence, the jury would likely reach the same verdict.
Oh, wow. So even a judge's mistake doesn't automatically guarantee a new trial.
Right.
The courts try to look at the bigger picture and determine whether the error truly affected the fairness of the proceedings.
Exactly. And that's why the concept of harmless error is so important. It prevents technicalities from, overshadowing the pursuit of justice.
This is all incredibly fascinating. But I have to admit, I'm still a bit fuzzy on how Olden v. Kentucky fits into the larger landscape of, Sixth Amendment law.
Yeah.
It can't be the only case where the courts have grappled with this issue of balancing the right to confront a witness with concerns about prejudice.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Olden builds upon a long line of cases that have wrestled with these, complex questions. One of the most notable is Davis v. Alaska, a case from 1974.
Right.
It also involved restrictions on cross-examination and the right to confront witnesses,
right,
highlighting the importance of, exposing potential bias, even if it involves sensitive information.
So it seems like the Supreme Court has been pretty consistent in its stance that that a defendant's right to challenge a witness's credibility is crucial to a fair trial.
Yes, and Olden v. Kentucky further solidified that principle.
Okay.
Making it clear that concerns about prejudice, they can't be used to completely shut down legitimate lines of questioning.
Okay, this is all really helpful context.
Yeah.
But I'm also curious about how Olden continues to influence legal battles today.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been over 30 years since that decision.
Right.
Surely the legal landscape has, you know, evolved, right?
Oh, it has. But Olden's principles are still very much alive, especially in cases involving sexual assault.
Okay.
In the wake of the hashtag MeToo movement.
Yeah.
We've seen a heightened awareness of the rights of both victims.
Yeah.
And the accused.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really complex and sensitive area.
It is.
You know, you want to protect victims.
Yeah.
And create an environment where they feel safe coming forward.
Mm-hmm.
But you also don't want to deny defendants their right to a fair trial.
Precisely. And Olden v. Kentucky provides a framework for navigating these, you know, these difficult questions. It reminds us that the right to confrontation isn't about being aggressive or insensitive. It's about seeking the truth by exploring all angles of a witness's testimony.
So it's not about, you know, scoring points or playing gotcha. It's about, you know, ensuring a just outcome for everyone involved.
Yeah.
So are you saying Olden v. Kentucky gives us a roadmap for handling these tricky questions that arise in cases today, especially those, you know, dealing with sexual assault allegations?
It certainly provides valuable guidance. It emphasizes the importance of, you know, carefully weighing competing interests and recognizing that open and thorough cross-examination is a crucial part of our adversarial system.
So it's a reminder that we can't shy away from potentially uncomfortable topics, even if they involve race, relationships, or other, you know, sensitive social dynamics.
You've got it. The pursuit of justice requires a willingness to engage with complexity.
Yeah.
And to confront those difficult questions head on.
Okay. So we've talked extensively about the majority opinion.
Yep.
And its impact. But I'm curious about the dissent in this case.
Mm-mm.
I mean, were all the justices in agreement with the ruling?
Well, not entirely. Justice Thurgood Marshall, while agreeing with the outcome, he actually wrote a separate opinion expressing concerns about the procedural aspect of the case.
Interesting. Tell me more about that. What was Justice Marshall's issue with how the case was handled?
He was worried about the use of summary reversal in this case.
Yeah.
Essentially, the Supreme Court, they reversed the lower court's decision without a full briefing and argument.
Okay.
Justice Marshall argued that this kind of, you know, shortcut can deprive litigants of a thorough hearing on the merits of their case.
So he's saying even though he agreed with the ultimate decision, he wasn't a fan of how the Supreme Court got there.
Exactly. He believed in a more deliberate process. Even when it came to, you know, seemingly clear-cut cases like this one, he argued that summary reversals carry a risk of the court making an error or issuing a decision that could confuse lower courts.
That's a valid point. It highlights the importance of, you know, procedure and due process,
mm-hmm.
even at the highest level of our legal system. It shows that even when the justices agree on the outcome, there can be disagreements
mm-hmm.
about, you know, the best way to reach that outcome.
Precisely. And Justice Marshall's dissent, it reminds us that there's, you know, always more than one way to look at a case.
Yeah.
Even when there's a seemingly unanimous decision, it emphasizes the importance of, you know, careful deliberation and a thorough consideration of all arguments.
I'm really starting to see why this case is considered such a landmark decision.
Yeah.
It's not just about the outcome.
Right.
It's about the principles it upholds, the debates it sparks, and the way it continues to, you know, shape legal thinking.
Yeah.
Even decades later.
It really is a testament to the, you know, the enduring power of the Sixth Amendment and the complexity of balancing, you know, competing rights and interests in the pursuit of justice.
Well said. So after diving deep into the legal arguments and historical context, what are some of the practical takeaways from Olden v. Kentucky? I mean, what lessons can lawyers and law students, you know, learn from this case?
That's a great question. And it's one that's particularly relevant for legal professionals who are in the, you know, the trenches of litigation. One of the key lessons is the importance of preserving objections.
Preserving objections. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you're a lawyer And you believe the opposing counsel is asking an improper question during cross-examination.
Right.
Especially one that might violate your client's, you know, right to confrontation.
Yeah.
You have to object, you know, clearly. And on the record.
Yeah.
This creates a legal trail that can be followed on appeal, just like Olden's lawyer did in this case.
Okay. So it's not enough to just, like, think an objection in your head.
Yeah.
You have to actually voice it and make sure it's documented.
Absolutely. You have to be, you know, vocal and persistent in protecting your client's rights. And this leads us to another important takeaway from Olden, the power of a detailed offer of proof.
Okay, an offer of proof. Tell me more about that.
An offer of proof is basically, it's your chance as an attorney to explain to the court what evidence you would have presented, you know, if you had been allowed to. It's your opportunity to demonstrate why the excluded evidence is relevant, right, and how it could have impacted the outcome of the case.
So it's like saying, hey, judge, if you had let me ask these questions or present this evidence, here's what the jury would have heard.
Hmm.
And it would totally change their minds.
You got it. A strong offer of proof can be crucial in, you know, getting a decision overturned on appeal. It allows the appellate court to assess whether the exclusion of evidence was truly harmless or whether it significantly prejudiced your client.
This is all starting to make sense now.
Good.
But there's one more thing I'm curious about. We've talked about, you know, confronting witnesses, sensitive topics and all that.
Yeah.
But what about the jury? I mean, they're the ones who ultimately decide the case.
Right.
How do we make sure they're not unfairly influenced by things like, you know, racial bias or preconceived notions about relationships?
That's where limiting instructions come in.
Okay.
These are, you know, instructions given to the jury by the judge, guiding them on how to consider, you know, certain evidence or testimony.
So the judge can say something like, okay, folks, you've heard this testimony about the relationship, but you can't use it to, you know, assume the defendant is guilty.
Right.
You have to consider all the evidence and apply the law as I've explained it to you.
Exactly. Limiting instructions can help, you know, mitigate potential prejudice and ensure that the jury focuses on the relevant legal issues.
Right.
However, as Olden v. Kentucky demonstrates, these instructions shouldn't be used as a shield to prevent the presentation of crucial evidence that could be vital to a defendant's case.
Right. So it's like walking a tightrope, isn't it?
Yeah.
Balancing the need to, you know, protect witnesses and prevent prejudice with the right of the accused to present a full and fair defense.
You've hit the nail on the head. And Olden v. Kentucky serves as a reminder that achieving justice requires a delicate and nuanced approach.
Yeah.
One that, you know, upholds the Constitution while ensuring a fair trial for everyone involved.
I feel like my brain is overflowing with legal knowledge right now.
That's a good thing.
Yeah.
But before we wrap up this deep dive into Olden v. Kentucky, I have a question for you.
I'm all ears.
Given everything we've discussed about Olden v. Kentucky, how do you think this case would play out in today's world, you know, with social media, instant news,
right,
and heightened scrutiny of legal proceedings? I mean, do you think the outcome would be different?
Hmm.
Would the court's reasoning hold up under, you know, the microscope of modern public opinion?
Wow, that's a really thought-provoking question. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I'm not sure I have an easy answer. It definitely gives me a lot to think about.
And that's precisely what we, you know, hope to achieve with these deep dives.
Right.
To spark thoughtful conversations and encourage a deeper understanding of the complexities of our legal system.
Well, you've definitely succeeded with me. This has been an incredible journey through the intricacies of Olden v. Kentucky.
It's been a pleasure exploring this landmark case with you. But before we conclude our deep dive, we want to leave you with a final thought to ponder.
Okay.
Something that, you know, builds upon what we've discussed.
Right.
But takes it a step further.
All right, hit me with that final thought. I'm ready for it.
So here's a question for you to consider. In today's world, where social media and the 24-hour news cycle can instantly amplify accusations and shape public opinion, how do we ensure that the principles of Olden v. Kentucky, you know, the right to confrontation, the presumption of innocence, and the importance of due process, how do we make sure they remain strong and effective?
Hmm. That's a fantastic question, and honestly one that deserves its own deep dive. It really gets to the heart of how our legal system grapples with the, you know, the challenges of our modern hyper-connected world.
It's a crucial question, and we encourage all our listeners to continue exploring these issues, to engage in, you know, thoughtful discussions, and to remember that upholding justice requires constant vigilance and a commitment to fairness, even when it's difficult.
Beautifully said. And on that note, we'll wrap up this deep dive into Oldham v. Kentucky. Until next time, stay curious, keep learning, and remember, the law is a fascinating and ever-evolving journey.
See you next time.
Okay, so we're back. And I feel like we've really gone deep into Oldham v. Kentucky, you know, dissecting the facts, the Supreme Court ruling, unpacking these legal concepts like harmless error. We even dug into the strategy Oldham's lawyer used.
Yeah, we covered a lot of ground. We talked about how Oldham fits into this like bigger picture of Sixth Amendment law and how these principles are still relevant today, especially in cases where, you know, sensitive social issues and the right to a fair trial kind of bump up against each other.
Yeah, it's been really eye-opening. I mean, I feel like I've gotten this new understanding of, like, how complex the legal system is and this delicate balance that the courts have to find between, you know, competing rights, different interests.
Definitely. But what about you? Like, what stands out to you? What's the big takeaway from Oldham v. Kentucky? What's the one thing that you're going to, like, remember from this case, you know, after we're done?
You know, I think for me, it's the power of, you know, good lawyering. Oldham's lawyer, he didn't just like react to what the prosecution was doing. He was already a step ahead, you know, mm-hmm. like he built this strategic case that really showed how the witness's story didn't add up. And then he linked those inconsistencies to a reason, a possible reason why she would lie.
Yeah, that's a good point. It shows how a good lawyer, even if the case seems weak at first, can really turn things around by like telling a story, you know. Mm-hmm. Creating a narrative that the court understands and that exposes, you know, the problems with the other side's arguments.
So it's not just about, you know, listing the facts.
Right.
It's about persuading, being strategic, being able to connect these pieces of information that seem separate and make them into something that makes sense, something compelling.
Exactly. And Oldham v. Kentucky is like the perfect example of how a lawyer can use like legal precedents, the rules of evidence, and even, you know, an understanding of psychology to really fight for their client.
Yeah. And sometimes I guess the most important evidence isn't, you know, some obvious proof or a confession. It's those little things, right?
Right.
The inconsistencies, the motives people might be hiding, the things that just don't quite fit. And it takes a really good lawyer to find those things and use them to build a strong argument.
Absolutely. Oldham shows us how important it is for lawyers to really think critically, to question what they're told, to look deeper and find the truth. Even when it's complicated or uncomfortable.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest thing I've learned from this case. Justice, it's not always easy or clear.
No, it is.
It takes like constant attention, a willingness to deal with tough issues, and a commitment to you know, everyone's rights, all the parties involved, even when those rights seem to be clashing with each other.
Yeah, that's a really powerful insight. And it's something we can all take with us outside the courtroom. It's a reminder that whenever we're trying to find the truth or make things fair, we have to be open to the complexity, to question what we think we know, and to really listen to everyone involved.
Well said. This deep dive into Oldham v. Kentucky has been, well, it's been amazing. A real lesson in legal strategy, the Constitution, and this constant effort to make our legal system fair and just.
It's been great exploring this case with you. And as always, we want to leave you with something to think about, something that goes beyond the specific case and makes you think about, like, the bigger picture.
Okay, I'm ready. What's that final thought-provoking question you've got for our listeners?
Here it is. As technology keeps changing, you know, and we have all these new ways of communicating, how should they apply the principles of Oldham v. Kentucky to make sure things are fair, to protect the right to confront your accuser in a world where evidence might be, you know, social media posts, text messages, maybe even virtual reality recordings?
Wow, that's a great question. I mean, it really shows how the legal system is always having to adapt to new things, to these changes that happen so fast with technology. It reminds us that the pursuit of justice, it's not like a finish line you cross.
Yeah.
It's more like a conversation, always ongoing, and we have to keep rethinking our ideas and changing our approach to make sure everyone gets a fair shot.
Well said. I think that's a perfect way to end this. It's like a challenge for all of us to think critically about the future of our legal system, to talk about how to make sure justice wins in this world that's always changing.
Exactly. Thanks for joining me on this deep dive into Oldham v. Kentucky.
And to everyone listening, thank you for being here with us. We hope you learned something new, got a new perspective, and maybe even started some interesting conversations of your own.
Until next time, keep that curiosity alive, stay involved, and always keep fighting for justice wherever you are.